Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We'll begin today by taking another look at a political story that shocked the political world on Tuesday. We're talking about House Majority Leader Eric Cantor's loss in his party primary race to political newcomer David Brat. David Brat still has the general election to face, but there's been an immediate consequence. Leader Cantor has decided to step down early from his leadership post, setting off a fight to replace him as second in command to Speaker John Boehner. We're also wondering not just about what happened in Cantor's district, but also what effect, if any, this will have on the fate of big issues pending in the House, particularly immigration reform, which is one of the issues David Brat campaigned on. So we've called Ron Christie. He's a former assistant to Vice President Dick Cheney and President George W. Bush. He's now a Republican strategist and communications advisor. Welcome back. And he's here in Washington, D.C.
Always a pleasure
to
be with you.
Fernando Espuelas is host and managing editor of the Fernando Espuelas Show on Univision. He's here in Washington, D.C. as well. Welcome back to you.
Thank you so much, Michelle.
So let me start with a clip from the victory speech of David Brat, who beat Eric Cantor. Here it is.
This campaign was about just basic American values and virtues right from the beginning, and the basic premise is power belongs to the people, and that's what we're going to do.
And that power belongs to the people line was important because David Brat was considered a kind of a Tea Party favorite. But now there's this storyline emerging that the real issue really isn't any big issue of David Brat, is that Eric Cantor was deeply unpopular in his own district with his constituents who felt he'd lost touch. So the question I have, Ron Christie, is first of all, which argument do you credit? And why didn't he know that? I mean, he was vastly over, he vastly outspent David Brat. Why didn't he know he was in trouble?
Well, this race is amazing to me, Michelle, because you're looking at someone who'd amassed the better part of $5 million, and his opponent had less than $200,000. I think Eric Cantor honestly spent more time on K Street here in Washington, D.C., with the lobbyists and the special interest community, rather than Main Street back in his district, back down near Richmond, Virginia. And this really honestly doesn't surprise me all that much. There's been a rumor for several years that Cantor has lost touch with his constituents. Now, the fact that he would lose to someone who was a political unknown from Randolph-Macon College, which is not necessarily on a lot of people's radar screens, might be surprising. But again, if you spend more time with the lobbyists and the special interests and don't take care of Tip O'Neill's old adage that all politics is local, you're going to find yourself back at home.
Interestingly enough, David Brat is facing another professor from the same college in the general election. But I want to focus on immigration reform. And Fernando, this is one of the reasons we called you, is because you've been covering it very closely, speaking with people on both sides, you know, of the aisle and on all sides of the issue on your program. Some people are saying that Cantor's support for an immigration initiative, a Republican immigration initiative, cost him conservative support because David Brat then portrayed him as pro-amnesty. And this is what Eric Cantor himself had to say about this at his press conference yesterday.
So. My position on immigration has not changed. It didn't change from before the election, during the election, or the way it is today. You know, I have always said the system is broken. It needs reforms. I think it is much more desirable and, frankly, doable if we did it one step at a time, working towards where we have common ground and believe things in common.
But do you credit that argument that this support for this Republican alternative is what cost him?
I don't really. I mean, I think it's an element of it, certainly. But I would agree with Ron that he was just so disconnected from his district. I think his disapproval ratings were in the 60s, which is not a good place to be when you're spending $5.3 million, I think it was, Ron. But look, he was never a supporter of immigration reform. Just what he said right now is nonsensical. The Senate has said over and over again, we will not consider little pieces to what is a very big problem. And I think that, that Cantor probably was trying to play with both sides. At the end of the day, my sources in Congress tell me that he was probably the biggest blockage to actually bringing a vote on the floor. And so I don't think really immigration is the main issue here.
So you don't feel the loss of his presence per se has any effect on whether this issue will proceed or not?
Well, I think it's going to be manipulated by many sides. I know the Democrats are saying it has no impact, and therefore we should just keep, you know, it will happen somehow in the next 4 weeks, which I think is rather wishful thinking. But I also think that Tea Party types will use it to frighten Republicans into saying, if you have any support for immigration reform, we will come after you. I think at the end, they're drawing the wrong lesson. They are alienating key voting groups, Hispanics principally, to such a degree that I think they're converting the National Republican Party into the California Republican Party, where there are no statewide elected officials after Governor Pete Wilson went after immigrants.
Ron Christie, what's your perspective on this?
Well, I spent a lot of time on Capitol Hill yesterday, and I think that immigration is dead this year. It's over. Because it was anyway? I think it was on life support before. I mean, I had members say to me yesterday, done, it's over, we're stunned, we're not going down the way that Cantor went down. And I think there are two lessons to draw from this. First, I think that a lot of members of Congress right now recognize that this is going to be a very volatile election. This is no longer going to be just because incumbents are reelected with a 92% overall in their campaigns. This year is different. People are very upset about the economy. People are very upset about the seeming lack of direction in our foreign policy. And I think all the members that I've spoken to, particularly yesterday, get the feeling that they've been home for a couple of weeks with their constituents, and their constituents are angry, and they think that Washington is broken and it's not working. And I think Cantor's defeat is only one manifestation of this. I think it portends a broader trend that we're going to see in November.
If you're just joining us, we're having our political chat. Our guests are Republican strategist Ron Christie and Fernando Espuelas, host and managing editor of the Fernando Espuelas. So, well, you know, Fernando, because, you know, you talked about the fact that this anti-immigration sentiment, mm-hmm. or at least the way it's expressed, is very mm-hmm. damaging to Republicans among key constituencies.
Sure.
But do you want to mention that, of course, Arnold Schwarzenegger was a nominal. Well, there was a Republican. He ran as a Republican and did become governor of California, but had a very different message on that. But the fact is, you know, Latinos are not very present as a political force in a district like Eric Cantor's for all kinds of reasons.
Right.
But so if that's not the case, I mean, this may be true on a national level, but on a district-by-district level, it doesn't seem to be. I mean, do you credit Ron's perspective on this? That actually, whether you think it should matter on the substance or on a granular level, it matters as these individuals look at their own individual districts and say, if that's not the sentiment of my constituents, then I'm not going to go there.
Well, I think going back to the California example, since Pete Wilson in the early 90s tried to essentially bring forth the equivalent of the Arizona anti-immigrant law, the percentage of Hispanic voters in every single election in California has increased, every single election, to the point now that you cannot be elected in California unless you carry the Hispanic vote. And I think that was a catalyst, that Pete Wilson was a catalyst. And I think when you look at the pathetic level of Hispanic registration, 40% of eligible voters not registered, I mean, it's just purely pathetic. These kinds of events are the stimuli that essentially create an electorate. And that's, frankly, what's going to happen.
Ron Christie, what lesson do you draw from, say, the Lindsey Graham example, a South Carolina senator who was perceived to be in trouble, mm-hmm. and he won his primary race also against a Tea Party opponent. How do you read that? Is this an issue between, say, the difference between a congressional district and a Senate race? Is it like the bigger the canvas, the easier it is to make an argument for comprehensive reform or to take a stand on big issues? How do you interpret those very different results?
Well, I think Fernando had it right a few moments ago. Look, I think Lindsey Graham is a very good politician, both here in Washington dealing with lobbyists and special interest groups, and he's very good when he goes back at home and he deals with his constituents. So you could make the argument that Eric Cantor played and touched all the right bases here in town, but he didn't touch the most important base, which is his hometown constituents, whereas Lindsey Graham made the sale. Lindsey Graham went home. People like Lindsey Graham. You know, there's this big cacophony here in Washington of, oh, you know, he's John McCain's sidekick and all this. But they like him in South Carolina. And his election in this primary only proves that.
Talk a little bit, if you would, about the leadership race. And I understand for a lot of people this is very arcane and kind of inside baseball stuff. But as we see, these figures do become national figures and they do have an impact. So thoughts about the scramble to replace Eric Cantor, who, as we said, is second in command to John Boehner.
Eric Cantor is the House Majority Leader. The House Majority Leader is in charge of setting not only the agenda of which bills will receive a vote on the House floor and which ones won't come to the floor, but they also really have the job of taking the pulse of the House Republican Conference now that they're in the majority. This is a very important election. I think that the odds-on favorite is Kevin McCarthy from California, who's the whip. The whip's job is to count all the votes for a very important legislation coming to the floor. But this is where I think the Tea Party could have an impact here. The Tea Party wants one of theirs at the leadership table. They're not happy with John Boehner. They're not happy with Eric Cantor. And they're saying, you're not listening to us. You're not listening to our concerns. I think you might have an outside candidate, someone, a Tea Party representative, someone like Pete Sessions from Texas, someone like Jeb Hensarling from Texas, to really take a good shot at running to make sure that other voices are at John Boehner's leadership table.
And finally, Fernando, is there anybody who bridges that? You know, you're talking about the sleeping giant of the Latino vote, mm-hmm. which is certainly very present in, you know, used to be a regional vote, is now becoming a national
right.
vote. Is there somebody who bridges both the kind of the Tea Party side and also talking about bringing new voices to the table ensures that the Republican brand is not permanently damaged on the national level? Is there anybody you see in the offing in the leadership race who could do that?
Well, I mean, no, not right now. The Congress seems to me so out of whack with at least the Hispanic electorate that it's very difficult to see who that person would be. It's from, you know, bad to worse in terms of what their declarations are all about. But I, you know, I would agree. I think Lindsey Graham is someone who is a politician of integrity, and he says what he means, and he expresses it well. And so you may or may not agree with the full spectrum of his opinions, but you feel like you're talking to a real person who loves America principally and then the party.
Okay, but he's not a candidate for majority leader in the House.
But,
he's a senator. So
no.
Is there anybody in the Senate, in the House?
Right. Yeah. I'm saying, who is that person in the House? I don't know that person in the House.
Well, we'll keep watching and we'll keep talking to you all about it. Thank you both so much. Fernando Espuelas is host and managing editor of The Fernando Espuelas Show on Univision. He was here with us in Washington, D.C., along with Ron Christie, former assistant to Vice President Dick Cheney and President George W. Bush, now a Republican strategist and communications advisor. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Great to be with you.
Coming up, President Obama is promoting a new plan to help people chip away at that growing mountain of student debt. We're asking if it will make a difference.
It helps, but it's a bit like closing the barn door after the horse is gone.
We're talking student loans. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
This man was a dedicated environmental activist, but he no longer fights the big battles. Instead, he's preparing for the ecological collapse to come.
I mean, I'm still old enough to remember when we were trying to stop climate change. Nobody talks about stopping climate change anymore. They talk about ameliorating it at most.
Stories of adaptation, climate and otherwise, on the next Big Picture Science.
Saturday evening at 5 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Lincoln Square in Urbana, a lifestyle center which includes unique and independently owned specialty shops and restaurants like Pieto and Pieto 2, Tang Dynasty, and The Great Impasta.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We want to spend some time talking about a subject that we follow closely on this program, and that is education. In a few minutes, we'll talk about changes the Obama administration wants to make to student loan repayment terms. But first, we'd like to talk about some news coming out of California, where a Los Angeles Superior Court decision could wind up being a landmark that sets off nationwide changes to job protection laws for teachers. In a sweeping decision, a Superior Court judge decided that California's teacher tenure laws are unconstitutional, saying that the laws violate the civil rights of low-income and minority students by making it hard to fire bad teachers. Those who support the decision say it's a win for students because it helps remove grossly ineffective teachers from the classroom. But teacher unions are up in arms, saying the decision will make it harder to recruit and retain qualified teachers. For more on this, we turn to Stephen Sawchuk, assistant editor for Education Week. He covers teacher-related policy and rights for the Teacher Beat blog, and he's with us now in our Washington, D.C. studios. Welcome. Thanks so much for coming.
Thanks for having me.
What exactly did the ruling say? I have to note that the language was very strong.
Very strong. You know, essentially, the judge agreed with the plaintiffs, nine students and their families, with their argument that these teacher protection laws, and by that we mean tenure, we mean the lengthy process for dismissing a tenured teacher, and also some of the seniority provisions, which require more junior teachers to be laid off before more experienced teachers, were disproportionately saddling students of color and disadvantaged students with the weakest teachers.
Now, we know that teacher tenure policies have become a kind of a focus of attention of a lot of people who believe that our educational system needs to be shaken up. So what's significant about this? I mean, is this the first time that there's been a legal case directed at teacher tenure policies? I mean, how are these policies generally managed? I mean, I thought this is mainly a matter of collective bargaining.
Tenure policies are actually normally set by states. They're mostly written into state law. And typically, the way they're changed is through legislative action. That's been hard in California. There have been a number of attempts to make it easier to get rid of teachers accused of malfeasance, for instance. And those have typically been blocked by the California teachers' unions. In this case, the plaintiffs went the judicial route. And I think what's really important to understand about this, you have to understand a little bit about education equity cases in the past. I mean, everyone knows Brown versus Board of Education. But in the 70s and 80s, people looked at things like educational equity and adequacy, mostly from a finance perspective. And so there were a number of rulings that said that, well,
funding. People mainly
funding,
addressed this through
exactly.
Funding. They said this district is getting less than this district, and let's
These
talk about
These schools are
that.
Getting less. We have to equalize this. This is the first ruling that has said it is not just about the money. We have to make sure that there is equitable access to quality teaching and instruction. It's the first time we've ever seen a ruling like that.
So just let me understand this. Is the ruling saying that having a qualified teacher is a civil right?
The ruling is saying that disadvantaged kids cannot have a disproportionate share of poor performing teachers.
Talk a little bit, if you would, about the specific circumstances in California. How is teacher tenure awarded there?
Teacher
and why
tenure.
Do you think, I'm just curious, because we note, I have to note again that some of the people involved in this case are national figures, like the former Solicitor General Theodore Olson, who's taken on, you know, a number of high profile cases, not just in the education area, for example, around same-sex marriage. He argued a significant Supreme Court case involving that. So what are there specific circumstances in California that got activists involved in looking for a case to address this issue?
Teacher tenure in California is granted after 2 years. Most states, it's 3 years or more. So that was one issue. The other thing is that the particular protections it confers are different in every state. In California, the process can go on as long as 10 years. It's incredibly expensive, and a lot of districts don't want to do all of the documentation and go through the multiple appeals it typically takes. And so that was one of the reasons it was brought there. There are other states, for instance, where if a teacher gets several successive poor evaluations, they can be returned to probationary status. California doesn't have rules like that.
So do you have the sense that, I mean, I think this is something that perhaps a lot of people don't know, is that sometimes people who are trying to use the courts to advance a particular issue go look for a place in order to bring a case. They look for specific circumstances, or they look for a specific venue. Do you have the sense that kind of national advocates who wanted to address the teacher tenure issue were looking for a specific case here? Is it California overall, or did something happen with these particular students? There were nine plaintiffs who were students in the system. Did something happen in their circumstances that made this an attractive place to test this issue?
I think California's laws are unusual in that they're so specific. I mean, not that many laws specifically say that you can only lay off junior teachers before senior teachers, regardless of how good they are. In many cases, that's more a function of the contract and can be bargained in or out.
So what are the next steps here? We mentioned that this issue is already being appealed, as you would imagine.
Two things. There's the appeals, and of course, that can go either way, depending on how the appellate court reviews the evidence. The other thing is that I think it will cause the California legislature to take a really close look at these laws. I mean, there is pressure on them to address this. And in fact, if you read the ruling carefully, there are some bright lines in there. The judge says, for instance, that, well, all these other states take 3 years to earn tenure. So if I were a betting man, I would say I would look for a proposal in the legislature to increase the time to tenure and possibly weed out some of these steps that it takes to remove an ineffective teacher.
Given that California is a bit of an outlier in this area now, does it seem as though this will set off a national chain reaction? I mean, if California moves basically to bring its practices in line with those that are practiced by most other states, is there really going to be that sweeping in effect? Because it just seems from the reaction that you're getting from a teacher advocacy groups and also from people who support this ruling, it seems to me that people really think this is going to set off shockwaves.
So, I have two opinions on that. First, I think legislatures the country over will be looking at their own laws and trying to get a sense of how they all merge, like the ones in California. I am going to throw a little bit of cold water on the idea, though, that we're going to see legal challenges of this nature everywhere. Because if you read the ruling very carefully, it cites mostly California case law and precedent. I mean, there have been equitable education lawsuits in other states, but courts interpret those terms differently. Adequacy, even teacher tenure has different meanings in different states. So I don't think it's a slam dunk to use this California precedent in a state where the case law is different. I think that they're going to have to really look at that with respect to the specific laws in the other states.
Finally, tell me a little bit about the group that brought this case. I mean, this was 9 families represented by a group called Students Matter. I note again that a very high-powered legal team brought this before the Los Angeles Superior Court. Tell us a little bit about this group and what's behind their thinking here.
You know, one of the things the teachers' unions have been pointing out, you know, they've said, you know, this is a smokescreen. This isn't about equity. It's about trying to undermine the teachers' unions. And they've pointed out the fact that these students are bankrolled by this group and that this group has ties to donors that have not been particularly friendly towards teachers' unions in the past. On the other hand, the group itself would say that this is an issue of you know, economic development in California. We need to have the best teachers. We need to have the best educated students, and that these laws are sort of on the face value of things preventing that.
I understand that the major donor behind this group is David Welsh, who's a Silicon Valley technology mogul who spent millions of dollars creating this organization. But what's the stated intention of Students Matter? Is it to bring cases like this? Is it to bring legal cases like this? Or do they have other things that
so far this
them?
Is the main thing they've really worked on, and I haven't seen any other particular initiatives coming from them. Their stated goal is to ensure that all students are taught by effective teachers.
Stephen Sawchuk is an assistant editor for Education Week. He covers teacher-related policy. He writes for their Teacher Beat blog, and he was kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studio. Stephen Sawchuk, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks again.
We've been talking about a big issue in K-12 education. Now we want to head to college, where one of the biggest issues for most Americans is paying for it. Now there's a new effort to help. This week, President Obama signed an executive order that will cap student loan repayments at 10% of income for millions of borrowers. In addition, some students will see their loan balances forgiven after 20 years of repayment or after 10 years if they work in public service. Now this change expands a program that already exists, but which has had limited reach so far. And we wanted to ask if these changes are important and what they might accomplish. So we've called Anthony Carnevale. He is the director and research professor at the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. And he often joins us for conversations about higher education. He's back with us in Washington, D.C. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So this executive order expands the administration's pay-as-you-earn policy. The feedback that we're getting so far is that this program really hasn't affected that many people so far. So the question is, will this include more people?
In the end, this will give income-based repayment, that is, you only pay a certain percentage of what you make, to a larger share of people. But we're only talking about a few hundred thousand people out of, there are 37 million people out there with college loans and We'll get another $18 million this year alone. So one of the characteristics of this program is that we know it's a very good idea. In the UK and in Australia, it is the default position. That is, you pay as you go, pay as you earn. Unless you ask to do otherwise, you can expedite your payment if you like, and they end up with much lower default rates and much more limited effects on students' ability to buy cars, houses, and start families.
Why is it that the reach is not greater? What is it about the drafting of this program that doesn't extend to that many people?
The difficulty is that students are unaware of it. It is additional paperwork. It's not clear how it is that you'd find out. What we know is that students don't seek these kinds of repayment programs out, and in many cases, even students who default never knew about these options. And so in other countries, we simply made them the default option. That is, this is what you do unless you decide to pay faster. So it's really a question of reach in this case.
Is part of the problem, though, that the people who actually service the loans, who send the paperwork out, are for-profit entities? And so why do they have any incentive to have students pay less? I mean, don't they get fees based on how much the students pay back? So if they're paying back less, there's less profit? I mean, isn't that part of it?
Part of it is that people who are dealing directly with the students have no interest in this to the extent, in fairness to them, it would add cost. That is, there'd be a certain amount of servicing the students that would be involved, and we're not opting to pay for that either. So, and even in the case of the people in the government that deal directly with students, they're not equipped to service students, to give them what is essentially sort of aggressive consulting and help with figuring out their own situation and what to do.
So how does this address the issue? I think that it is now known that student loan debt is a tremendous issue. It's a tremendous issue both for individuals, and it's a tremendous drag on the economy, because people who are carrying around these massive debts are not in a position to buy cars, to buy houses. It has tremendous implications that we are now becoming aware of. How does this affect that at all?
It helps, but it's a bit like closing the barn door after the horse is gone. That is, the loan debt that students carry, there's a more fundamental question about it, and that is, are they getting value for money? That is, students take out large amounts of loan, and that's fine. The students should pursue what they love, but in the end, the loans come due, and that, to a certain extent, is a fairly rude awakening from the dream. So there's a fundamental issue here about getting the loan and ensuring that you're getting value for the money that you're borrowing.
One of the things that you've been concerned about is getting people to take more seriously the cost-benefit analysis of whatever it is that they're doing. And one of the concerns I know that you have and that a lot of people have is that students and their parents and their families aren't necessarily taking that question as tightly as you would like them to do. What does this really cost, and what am I really going to get out of it at the end? Is there any part of you that's concerned that this kind of adds to the temptation not to think about it because you think to yourself, well, I'm only going to have to pay 10% of my income. It's not going to be that big of a deal. Even if you don't wind up actually filling out the paperwork, even if you don't wind up, you know what I mean? Does any of that worry you?
It does. That is, if we build a system where we continue to forgive the fact that the students and their parents and the institutions and the government that gives the money away, if we continue to forgive the fact that we're really not building a system where we give loans for value, that is, for long-term earnings, then we continue the inefficiencies in the system. Ultimately, the taxpayer pays for that, as do many of the students who find these loans still overwhelming. That is, it's not as helpful if you've built a loan and it's going to burden you for a number of years. Just have somebody help you with the burden. The real issue is ensuring that you minimize the burden in the first place by linking value to economic value to the loan.
Finally, as I understand it, the president's expansion of the program doesn't even go into effect until December of 2015, because that's how long it takes for the Education Department to get the new regulations into effect. So, you know, at the end of the day, is this more a matter of political signaling, letting, you know, the president wanting to say, I'm on your side and those other guys aren't? Or do you think this really will have a real effect, if at least it just opens the door to people understanding that this is an option that is in effect in other places and therefore something that this country should really consider?
I think in the end it is progress on the road to real policy. It affects real people in substantial numbers, although not near what we would hope. And in the end, it continues to raise the question as to what we do more fundamentally with loans, as to whether or not we ensure that young people know what they're getting into when they borrow and make sure they're not borrowing trouble down the road. So I do think it has a real palpable impact on people, but it is relatively limited.
Anthony Carnevale is director and research professor at the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. We caught up with him, or he was nice enough to go to our bureau in New York. Mr. Carnevale, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Yeah, good talking to you.
Coming up, Beyoncé has conquered the stage, the screen, and the fashion world is the classroom next. She is the inspiration for a summer course at Rutgers University. But do you have to learn the steps to Single Ladies to earn an A?
You don't, but I always welcome a little dance break in the middle of class.
We'll hear more from the instructor behind politicizing Beyoncé. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Carnegie Corporation, proud supporter of StoryCorps, sharing stories of new citizens. More at greatimmigrants.carnegie.org. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to build a culture of health for all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
As I'm sure you know, Hillary Clinton is on a book tour. On the next Fresh Air, she makes a stop on our show. What will I ask her? How will she respond? You and I will find out on the next Fresh Air.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Friends of WILL and from Urbana's Market at the Square, happening every Saturday morning, rain or shine, from 7 a.m. to noon at the corner of Illinois and Vine Streets in historic downtown Urbana. Learn more at urbanaillinois.us/market.
Hi, I'm Diane Noland, host of Mid-American Gardener on WILL-TV. Join me and my panel of experts each week as we discuss lawn and gardening care tailored to Zone 5 growing conditions. We'll also answer your gardening questions, so call in during the show or send an email for us to answer on the air. Join me for Mid-American Gardener Thursday nights at 7 on WILL-TV or listen Saturday mornings at 6:30 on AM 580.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. You might have heard of television personality Cesar Millan. You might know him as the Dog Whisperer or from his hit TV show Cesar 911, which airs on Nat Geo Wild. But what you might not know is that before the TV fame, the grooming stores, the dog psychology center, he was a homeless, undocumented immigrant from Mexico with a dream. Our friends at All Things Considered captured the story of how his career took off as part of their series called My Big Break.
My name is Cesar Millan, and I train people and rehabilitate dogs. I was born and raised on a farm, Mexico and Sinaloa. Lassie Rintintin were the show in my era. And I was fascinated about that. Fascinated how Timmy would tell, you know, Lassie, go get Uncle, whatever, and go to the fire department and tell them that I need help. I said, well, one day when I grew up, I'm going to go to America. I'm going to go to Disneyland or Hollywood, because that's where Lassie and Rintintin live. I knew I loved the idea of working with animals, something about it. And when I was 13 years old, I told my mom, you think I can be the best doctor in the world? And she said, you can do whatever you want. So I waited 8 years later, 21, and that's when I went back to my mother and said, I'm leaving. Where are you going? I'm going to America. So I went to Tijuana, and pretty much it took me 2 weeks to cross the border, and I came here illegally. After that, I was homeless in the streets of San Diego, and my home was under a freeway. One day, I went to a grooming salon because I'm a groomer myself. By then, I learned a sentence. Do you have application for work? That was my first sentence in English. One day, I entered into this grooming salon and two Caucasian ladies were there, older ladies, and I said, do you have application for work? And they started talking to me. I was in shock and, oh my God, I wasn't prepared for all of this. The good thing was that a Cocker Spaniel was in the back, and this Cocker Spaniel was very aggressive towards them. They gave me a clippers, and I went and grabbed the dog and started grooming him. And they were in shock because the dog didn't try to bite me, because I'm not afraid, you know? So I just come in calmly. I understand how he feels, gain the trust. That day, I make $60. I moved to Inglewood, California. And then I start going around the neighborhood, and I start walking dogs. And I start walking dogs off-leash. I didn't know it was illegal to walk dogs in America off-leash, in the land of the free, right? Especially where dogs have birthday parties. You know, dogs get married here. You know what I mean? And that's how people started calling me the Mexican guy who can walk a pack of dogs. I didn't have business cars. So my business car was the referral. You know, I started getting all these people all because I was walking dogs off leash. The LA Times followed me for 3 days. The last question she asked me was, so you had a great thing going on. What would you like to do next? And without hesitation, I said, I would like to have a TV show. The newspaper came on a Sunday. By Monday was a line of producers outside asking what was this show will be about. And that's how Dog Whisper was born.
That was television personality Cesar Millan. You can find his show Cesar 911 on Nat Geo Wild. And our colleagues at All Things Considered want to hear about your big break or about the stories that you've been hearing that inspire you. Send them an email at mybigbreak@npr.org. So it's summer or close enough. A lot of college campuses are open for business. In most classrooms, if a student walked in playing Beyonce loud enough for everybody to hear it, most professors would probably ask him or her to turn it off. But in Professor Kevin Allred's class, that student might be asked to turn it up.
Who won the world?
That's Run the World Girls, one of the songs you might learn more about if you took the Politicizing Beyoncé class at Rutgers University this summer. The man who teaches it, Kevin Allred, is with us now. Professor Allred, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So what do you teach normally? What's your subject?
Well, it's a women's and gender studies department that I'm in. So, you know, anything from 101 gender studies to more kind of specified classes like this new one on Beyoncé.
Why her? What is it about her that you find politically interesting?
Well, besides the fact that she's just one of, if not the most powerful person in pop culture right now, it seems like she's on top of everything. I read an article a few years ago by Daphne Brooks, professor at Princeton, and she was arguing that the B-Day album should be looked at politically in kind of line with black female protest singing throughout history. And I was really compelled by that, and I wanted to continue that and like think about all of Beyoncé's work post and pre B-Day and her career in general as a way to engage students around these conversations about race, gender, sexuality, and the politics of those categories in the United States especially was my interest. So it kind of blossomed out of there, as well as me being a fan of hers.
And you're in the Beehive.
Yeah.
You're in the Beehive.
I am.
As fans of Beyoncé are known. Should I out myself? That I'm also in the Beehive?
It's okay.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. I just feel in the spirit of full disclosure, we should probably disclose that we're all in the Beehive. You know, it's interesting because on the one hand, I'm sure you've gotten the, so this is what people are sending their kids to Rutgers to study.
Yeah.
Part of it. But it is a fact that Beyoncé has gotten a lot of attention from people outside of the pop culture world. I mean, in the same week that, you know, the Fox pundit Bill O'Reilly used a segment of his show to express shock at her video Partition, which is, you know, very much about, you know, sexuality. And then on the other side of the equation, the feminist scholar Bell Hooks, speaking on a panel at the New School in New York City, took issue with a Time magazine cover that Beyoncé was on, in which she posed in a typical Beyoncé outfit. And she actually used the word terrorist to describe her because she said that she felt that she imposed a sort of image on young women that she feels is not healthy. So kind of interesting that she's attracted a lot of attention. Why do you think that is? Is it because she has such a big footprint in the marketplace? Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I think, and especially after she kind of took everyone by surprise with the last album, which is unheard of in today's music industry, I think. And I think that directed everyone's attention to her immediately just because she kind of thwarted a lot of the industry ways that they've been putting out music. And she became, not that she wasn't already, she's, of course, you know, whenever Beyoncé does something, it's a news story. And she somehow manages to keep everything really private in her life, but yet be so public. And it's a weird juxtaposition of those two things. And I think that's what makes everyone kind of obsessed about her or obsess about her and think about every little move she makes. So, you know, whether it's one side of the coin wanting to come at her for being what they perceive as too sexual or too explicit, and then the other side of the coin where you have bell hooks already arguing this idea of putting forth an image that maybe is not so positive for young girls. I kind of see her point, but I think Beyoncé has so much control over her own image that if she chooses to put that image as what she wants on the Time magazine, I don't think anyone else is forcing her into dressing like that or being on the cover in that way. So in that way, I think that runs counter to what bell hooks was saying.
But let me jump in here, though, because the title of your course is Politicizing Beyoncé. I mean, some people might argue that the real place for a course about Beyoncé is the business school, because if she is anything, she is a successful business woman.
Oh, absolutely.
Certainly in the project of building the Beyoncé brand. Mm-hmm. But your course is about politicizing Beyoncé. Tell me what kinds of things you're going to talk about, think about. I mean, presumably, I mean, I know for the parents who are paying this, might be paying this tuition, you know, I presume you're not like lip syncing her videos and practicing her dance routines in your class.
So
what are you doing?
Yeah, no, I've gotten some of those emails thinking, you know, we're going to have a quiz on different Beyoncé facts. But what I'm actually doing is putting her in line with this longer history of black feminism and black feminist thought in the United States. So on the syllabus, I'll give a number of readings and a few songs that they should maybe think about or look at before coming to class. And then usually we start out with a video. So, for instance, we were talking about Grown Woman.
I remember being young and so brave. I knew what I needed. I was spending all my nights and days, lay back, daydreaming. Look at me, I'm a big girl now.
We had just watched her Life is But a Dream documentary kind of as an intro to get, you know, this is the way Beyoncé packages herself and wants us to see and know about maybe some of her more private moments. And we looked at Grown Woman alongside a reading by Melissa Harris Perry from her Sister Citizen book, a chapter about the way black women kind of experience the world, in the U.S. at least, as this kind of crooked room. And you either have to lean to see everything, orient yourself so it seems normal, or you stand straight and have to reorient your surroundings. Mm. And we talked about how she, in the Grown Woman video, how might she be thinking about the crooked room, leaning versus readjusting the world around her. You know, it always makes me think of the famous Audre Lorde, master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. You know, how is she using different tools to kind of reorient herself in the room? And we look at that through the video and the visuals that she presents.
So let me play a little bit of Pretty Hurts, which is from the latest album. This is, if there's one song that I think people might know at the moment where they would think there's a real message here, I think it would be Pretty Hurts. Let me play a little bit here. That is one, I think, song and a video that a lot of people would point to say, here's a person who is very much a part of that industry, who's very successful at being pretty in a conventional way, and she's turning it on its head in a video where she's presented herself as a beauty queen, but she's also showing a lot of the stuff that goes into that and the pain of getting to be that thin. It's pretty, it's actually kind of explicit in some, and I don't mean sexually, I mean in terms of showing the extreme lengths that some people go to meet that beauty ideal. But then some people would say she's got a completely contradictory message here. How do you reconcile this for yourself? Not to give everything away from the course, but how do you think about that? How do you encourage your students to think about that?
Well, I think it provokes a discussion. So for my class, this is great stuff because you have these two different sides where do these contradict? Can we somehow bring them together and see it as one fluid statement that she's making? And I tend to think of her work as these videos as small little pieces of performance, right? So I try and take away the Beyoncé as the person and, you know, what is she putting forth in this video? So the Pretty Hurts video or the song, even the lyrics are pretty straightforward about, you know, these detrimental facets of beauty or the way that we've stereotypically conceived beauty in the world. And she's exposing them at least. And maybe she's just showing that she's also been a part of this and maybe been a victim of these ideals of beauty, even though pretty much everyone agrees that Beyoncé is stereotypically beautiful, what we would consider to be beautiful. And then I take the sexuality of other videos, for instance, is more performance about, you know, we'll look at Partition next to writings about the way that black women's bodies have been seen over time or treated over time. And how in Partition is she performing the objectification of a black woman's body versus objectifying her own body? So I try and make those kind of distinctions about what she's doing. It's not her lifestyle necessarily that's in Partition, although who knows, maybe, you know, that is a private fantasy or something. We don't know.
Well, for those who haven't seen it, Partition is about having an intimate moment
with her
significant other in a limousine.
Traveling up the Partition fast. Over there, I swear I saw them cameras flash. Handprints and footprints on my glass. Handprints and good grips all on my private show with the music blasting. He likes to call me teachers when we get this nasty. Red wine drip, built top that trash. Chauffeur eavesdropping, trying not to crash. Water daddy, daddy, now you rip my fur. Oh, baby, baby, be sweating on my hair. 2:45 to get all dressed up. And we even gonna make it to this club.
That's what it's about. So.
Yes.
So before we let you go, Professor Allred, what would you say to people who wonder what is the value of studying Beyoncé or studying something like this? What do you say?
I think it gives students a critical eye, which young people need today, just in general, to think about their world, to think about, you know, whatever jobs they're going to go into. It's going to help you be critical about the world and about the pop culture that you're consuming. I mean, we're so inundated with images and, you know, radio, TV, reality TV, movies, all this stuff. We're kind of losing the critical eye on it. And I think it helps students see their world differently. And also it brings back a piece of history or a group of writers or, you know, a group of Black women that often get overlooked in other core courses that you're reading. You know, if you take a literature course, how many Black women are included in the writing? If you take a sociology course, how many Black women sociologists are included? So I'm trying to introduce the students to this body of literature that often gets overlooked in assigning it in other courses. It's the only thing I assign. So writings by Black feminists, Black women in a number of ways that people identify as Black women, I only include writings like that. So it's also a kind of political choice for me to get students reading this other body of literature. So they're going to learn something new, the same as they would in a history class or something else, you know, and they're going to come away with a critical understanding of the world around them.
And just to be clear, you don't get extra credit for learning the Single Ladies choreography.
You don't, but I always welcome a little dance break in the middle of class if we can just, you know, no. if there's a little time to break it up. We have a 4-hour class session, so if people want to dance for about 10 minutes in the middle, that's okay with me.
Kevin Allred is teaching the Politicizing Beyoncé course at Rutgers University this summer. He was nice enough to join us from our bureau in New York, taking a break from his 4-hour class. Professor Allred, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
On a single leg.
And that's our program for today.